Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star and one on your phones. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will turn the meeting over to Dr. Rao Kasaraju. You may go ahead.
It's my great honor. I'm Rao Kasaraju. I'm the Division Director of Computing Communication Foundation. It is my great pleasure to introduce Professor Moshe Wadia of Rice University. He is a George Distinguished Service Professor in Computational Engineering and Director of Ken Kennedy Institute for Information Technology at Rice. Before Rice, he used to be at IBM. When I knew he was moving from IBM, I was trying hard to hire him at Hopkins, but Rice and Ken Kennedy acted faster than we could. That's the reason he went there. So he is a truly eminent researcher. He's currently the editor-in-chief of CSEM. He got many, many awards, three IBM Outstanding Awards, IBM SIGAC Girdle Prize, Paris Kanellakis Prize, EATCS Distinguished Achievements Award. EATCS is equivalent to the SIGAC in the European community. He wrote over 500 papers, two books. It is not the number of papers. The most impressive thing is the quality of each and every one of those papers. He is truly remarkable in that sense. He's a fellow of every society, ACM, IEEE, SIAM, AAAS, AAAI. And he's a member of U.S. National Academy of Engineering, National Academy of Science, American Academy of Arts and Sciences, European Academy of Science, European Academy of Science, Academia Europea. You see, in computing, there is the sigma star. That is all finite strings over sigma. Say, maybe it would have been easier if I said National Academy Sigma Star, something like this. So he has several honorary doctorates from, for example, Saarland University in Germany, Orleans University in France, UFRGS in Brazil. He is a truly eminent researcher in all aspects of logic and computer science. A couple of years ago, he gave a talk at Johns Hopkins, a distinguished lecture talk. It was on a slightly different topic, always entertaining, thoughtful type of talks. It's my great pleasure to have Moshe here.
Thank you for this generous introduction. It reminds me of a story about three graduate students at MIT who wrote a paper together. And the first one had a footnote under his name, and he says AT&T fellow because he had a fellowship from the AT&T Foundation. The second one had the footnote Hertz fellow because he had a footnote from the Hertz Foundation, had a fellowship from the Hertz Foundation. And the third one had a footnote, it says, a jolly good fellow. So it's an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to give the SAIS a distinguished lecture. And I want to tell you about what I consider really a true revolution that happened in computer science, the theory and the practice and the cross-fertilization between the two of them. And I want to start with a little bit introduction, which hopefully I'll just be reminding you something that you're all familiar with. If you're a theoretical computer scientist, then the one big outstanding open question is P versus NP. And this is a question that has been in sex. So we'll recognize that it's considered even a major question in mathematics, and the Clay Institute has given a prize, has allocated $1 million for whoever is going to solve this problem. So what is it about? It's about what we call computational complexity, which is how hard it is to solve computational problems. What it is not about, this is what it is not about. This is a colleague of mine in the rally to, I think John Stewart organized this rally to ensure sanity, and he came up with this poster, Quality Now. So, what is a computational problem? I'll demonstrate by way of example. We're going to start with a graph, or graph often called a network, which is a set of nodes and a set of connections or edges or arcs. And there are two very similar problems that people ask about graphs. One, does a given graph have a Hamiltonian cycle, which is a cycle that visits every node exactly once? And a similar one is Eulerian cycle, which is a cycle that visits every edge exactly once. And we want to, given a graph, we want to find out Hamiltonian cycle, Eulerian cycle. In fact, the Eulerian cycle problem is the beginning of graph theory. In the 18th century, in Königsberg, was a city on Prussia, today it is Kaliningrad, it's a little tiny enclave of Russia between Lithuania and Poland. This is a map of Königsberg, and you see there is this river and an island, and there are seven bridges. And on Sunday afternoon, the citizens of the city would like to take a stroll, and the question came up, can you take a walk, start from one point, come back, and cross every bridge exactly once? So they couldn't solve the question. They couldn't figure out how to do it. And they had a famous mathematician, Euler. So they went to Euler, and Euler says, well, a piece of land can be collapsed to one point, and then you get a graph. Okay, so this is what graph theory comes about. And so Euler will say, I mean, what was his solution to this problem? So this is Eulerian cycle, this is trying to find Eulerian cycle, and this is a Hamiltonian cycle, is named after physicist Hamilton. This was a puzzle, this was a particular thing. Can you have a cycle here that visit every node exactly once? The answer in this case, yes, you can visit every node exactly once. So these are two classical questions in graph theory. And what we want to know is how hard it is to solve them. And what does it mean how hard it is? So very formally, we ask how many Turing machine operations does it take to solve a problem of size n? What is the size of a graph? Simply, you can say the number of nodes plus the number of edges. And we don't really think in terms of Turing machine operations, but this is a very robust measure, so we can just think in terms of any kind of machine operation, you know, even x86 operation. And the complexity class P are the problem can be solved in polynomial time, which is n to the c for some constant c. So n squared, n cubed, n to the fourth, n to the fifth, these are all polynomials. So some problems are easy, you know. Is a number even? All we have to do is to look at the last digit, see if it's even or odd. You can do it in linear time. The number square. Now, how do you check a number square? So I suspect that this is a matter of age, but the older people here probably were still taught how to extract square root in the long, just like long division, there was long square roots, and you may still remember it. Today you use, of course, a calculator. But if you look at the algorithm that maybe you have been taught, then it is actually a polynomial time algorithm. What about Eulerian cycle? So we can go back to the picture. And what Euler proved, it's actually a fairly easy proof, that the Eulerian cycle, if and only if every node has an even degree. Why? Because every time you enter, you have to get out. And here, we see that there are nodes with odd degree. So therefore, the answer was to the citizen of Königsberg, you cannot have an Eulerian walk on Sunday afternoon. What about Hamiltonian cycles? Can we do this in polynomial time? So we can try all possible cycles. So this is something like n factorial. This is a very large number. And to do it, just to go for n factorial to 2 to the n requires, it's a non-trivial exercise. Okay, you have to use dynamic programming. It's not simple to do it in 2 to the n. Now, if we take a graph let's say 200 nodes, and you do a 2 to the n algorithm, that means you have to do 2 to the 100 steps. If you take the age of the universe, let's say 15 billion years old, I'm rounding it up, and you imagine you have a computer that can do an operation every Planck time constant, which is, I think, 10 to the minus 44 of a second, the universe is not old enough to finish 2 to the 100. Okay? So this is a fundamental question in computer science. Can we do better than that? Can we do it in polynomial time? Now, a very fundamental observation here, which is due to independently to Cook and Levin, is that checking if a cycle is Hamiltonian is easy. All I have to check that it really is a true cycle, it goes along edges, and it visits every node exactly once. So it turns out there are many, many problems that, well, checking is easy. So Hamiltonian cycle is easy. Think of factoring numbers. Factoring numbers, we don't know how to factor numbers efficiently. But if I give a factorization, all you have to do is multiply them and check that you got the original number. And there are tens of thousands of problems. In all domains, they have this feature, you can check solutions in polynomial time. You can check solutions efficiently. So the P versus NP questions is a very fundamental mathematical question, which is the difficulty of finding solutions versus the difficulty of checking solutions. So this is the question we have been now asking ourselves now since roughly 1970. Is checking really easier than discovering? So intuitively, we say, of course checking is easier than discovering. That's how we think of our life. You know, we talk about finding a needle in the haystack. If I show you here is a needle, of course it's easy to look. Yeah, the needle is here, but finding it is hard. Solving Sudoku versus checking Sudoku. Checking is trivial. Finding is difficult. Difficult to come up with proofs, much easier to read proofs. But we do not know how to prove that solving is harder than checking. Still an open question. So we could imagine one universe in which P is different than NP. And on the bad side is that there are many difficult problems we are not going to be able to solve. On the other hand, cryptography is going to be safe, because if P equal NP, then we can break RSA, for example. And many years ago, when I was working at IBM, we had a physicist who was director of the lab, and one of his staff people came to me and said, the director wants to, and he said something about very fundamental. I said, okay. He said, you generally believe that P is different than NP? I said, yes. So the director wants to know, why don't you just accept it and move on? Which is what physicists would do, okay? So why don't you do that? And so I told him, look, there are really two reasons. One is because if we don't have a proof, to us it means we really do not understand it. We need to understand it. The proof is understanding. And secondly, you know, if P equal NP, maybe it's possible P equal NP, and the enemy, whoever the enemy is, you know, NSA, Chinese NSA, whatever you want, maybe they are reading our email, okay? So we need to know. Now we can imagine, what about the possibilities P equal NP? Scott Aronson, a computer scientist at MIT, wrote very beautifully. He said, if P equal NP, then the world would be a profoundly different place than we usually assume it to be. There would be no special value in creative leaps, no fundamental gap between solving a problem and recognizing the solution once it is found. Everyone who could appreciate a symphony would be Mozart. Everyone who could follow step-by-step proof would be Gauss. So he said, this is very unlikely. The good things, if we can solve, if NP equal P, then there are many, many problems we can solve in polynomial time, but RSA is not safe anymore. Now, again, the conventional wisdom is that P is different than NP. Is it possible that P equal NP? Absolutely. All it will take is to discover one very clever algorithm. And we should remember that most of the progress in complexity theory over the past 50 years was in discovering very clever algorithm. Linear programming, people thought it was not in P until someone found an algorithm that was in P. The literate method proved that it was in P. So it's quite possible. And I'll come back later to discuss again the significance of proving one way or another. Now, one of the beautiful theory that emerged in the early 70s was that we have a concept of NP complete problems, which are the hardest problem in NP in a very formal way. For example, Hamiltonian cycle is NP complete. It was shown by Karp in 1972. Because it is the hardest problem, P equal NP, if and only if Hamiltonian cycle is in polynomial time. For some reason, Hamiltonian cycle is a very tempting target. People publish proof every year. There is a website that publishes all the proof that people have published of P equal or not equal to NP. And Hamiltonian cycle is the favorite target to try. Let's find the polynomial algorithm and prove it once and for all. There are thousands of NP complete problems. So we all have to find one of them to solve, to prove it's in P or not in P, and we are done. This has been the set of affair now for many years. Now I want to give you a little kind of very, very quick view of the history of this. So in some sense, the early study of complexity theory go back to a program in the Soviet Union in the 50s and 60s. It was called the Perebor program. They realized that all these difficult problems, the best way, Perebor means exhaustive search. They tried very hard to show that it is inevitable, they could really make progress. Finally, in 71, proof cooked the Boolean satisfiability, which I'll review in a minute, is NP-complete. And then Karp showed that there are 20 other NP-complete problems. Leonid Levin was in an amazingly short paper, 3 pages paper, was able to do both what Cook and Karp did in one short paper independently. 1971, Gary Johnson came out, and many of us still remember. I still have a copy, which is falling apart now, but it still was a beautiful book, and that's really popularized the concept. And in 2000, Clay Institute said this is a significant enough question to merit an award of $1 million. Now, I mentioned Boolean satisfiability. This is Boolean satisfiability is the core problem of NP-completeness. Okay? This was the first NP-complete problem. And this goes to George Boole. So now we're going to go back to 1847, and George Boole has a fantastic insight. And the insight is that logic, which for the previous 2,000 years was a branch of philosophy, really can be sort of a branch of algebra. So here is a paragraph from his book. If an adjective as good is employed as a term of description, let us represent by letter as Y all things to which the description good is applicable, i.e. all good things, or the class of good things. Let it further be agreed that by the combination X times Y, so here I'm using the algebraic convention of designating multiplication by just juxtaposition, so X times Y, shall be represented, that class of things to which the name or description represented by X and Y are simultaneously applicable. Thus, if X alone stands for white things and Y for sheep, then X times Y stands for white sheep. So the insight here is that logical conjunction and can be thought of as a product operation. And logical OR is an addition operation, and so you have an algebra. And this is how Boolean algebra, which today, of course, play a key role in computer science, that's how Boolean algebra was born. Now, the question of Boolean satisfiability arose already in the 19th century, but it's usually formalized today in the following manner. This is a modern formalization. You imagine that you're given a Boolean expression from AND, OR, and NOT, so the wedge, the V, and the tilde. And the question is there a way to assign zeros and one to the variables here so the expression evaluates to one? So here we can see, if I take X1 and X2 to be 0 and X3 and X4 to be 1, then X3 becomes, this X3 is true, so this is true, and X4 is true, so this is true, and X3 is true here, so they're all true. So this whole thing evaluates to 1. Now here it's easy to do. There are three variables, so there are 2 to the 3, which is 8 possible assignment. It's easy to do it by just inspection, so to speak. Imagine what would happen if I had a formula that spread maybe the whole slide. That would already be not possible to do by inspection anymore. So already in the 19th century, people realized that this is a very important problem. And this is, if you do any kind of automated reasoning, you have to deal, first of all, with propositional logic. This is the weakest possible logic, okay? So any kind of reasoning that we have to do, you have to deal with Boolean reasoning. So already in the middle of the 19th century, people start, before they have any concept of computation, they wonder how to do it fast. So William Selin Givens, who followed after Boole, and in fact, Boolean algebra should be called Givens algebra because he gave the what we call to the Boolean, the formulation that we use today. He writes, I've given much attention, therefore, to lessening both the manual and the mental labor of the process. The process is Boolean reasoning. And I shall describe several devices which may be adopted for saving trouble and risk of mistake, and he built the first logic machine that still exists in some museum in the UK. It was called Logic Piano. It could handle 4 variables, so the state space is 16, not very impressive, but it's all by moving wooden pieces. So if you can do that, kudos to you. Erna Schroeder, a bit later, and German algebraist, getting a handle on the consequences of any premises, or at least the fastest method for obtaining these consequences, seems to me to be one of the noblest, not the ultimate goal of mathematics and logic. This is the ultimate goal of mathematics and logic, to solve this problem, which, as we know today, was shown by Cook and Levin, is NP-complete. So by the conventional wisdom of computer science, it's NP-complete, therefore hopeless. This is the way most of us have been trained. NP-complete means hopeless, don't waste your time. But there were several people who nevertheless wasted their time. And in fact, it goes back to the mid-50s. So we have to remember that the ENIAC is 1946. Really, in the 1950s, computers are just being built. I mean, there are maybe dozens of computers around the world. Newell, Shaw, and Simon write a program called Logic Theorist, able to prove all the propositional logic theorems from Principia Mathematica of Russell and Whitehead. And they're very proud of themselves. They write a letter to Russell. He responds very graciously. 1958, a technical report by Davidson Putnam, funded by the NSA. I always make sure to give them credit because I know they're listening. Computational method in the propositional calculus. Someone had the insight. This is relevant to cryptography. And then two published papers, 1960 in JCM, 1962 in CSEM, with Davis Patton, Davis Logman, and Lavnen, that gives us the basic theory of propositional reasoning. And the method that came out of it is called DPLL, Davis, Putnam, Logman, and Loveland, and which is basically, they say, converted to CNF. CNF is a conjunctive normal form. It looks like this, the conjunction of disjunctions. You can always convert it to CNF. And do a backtracking search. And there is one important heuristic, that if one of the disjunction has degenerated to be just one variable, then there's nothing more to choose, just take this assignment because you are forced to. This is it. So, from early 60s, for the next 30 years, very small group of people continue to do Boolean satisfiability. It can be complete, which means it's going to be hard. And they write programs and they can handle maybe some dozens of variables, and then a few hundreds of variables. But most of us thought that this was a waste of time. It's an NP-complete problem, and you'll never be able to solve really serious industrial problems. And then something happened in the mid-90s, and there is an explosion of new heuristics. And the heuristics have changed the game dramatically. Today we don't call them DPLL, we call them CDCL, closed-driven, closed learning. And I won't go and explain every heuristic in detail. Backjumping means that you do the backtracking and you try to jump up in the search tree as high as you can, rather than just go one level at a time. Unit clause preference. So unit clause preference, I say, when you see a variable that is a unit variable, just jump at it and make force the assignment to be true. This is very, very trivial part. It's very, very easy to implement, except that people did profiling, they discover that 80% of the time you're doing this trivial operation of updating counters because you want to keep a count next to every clause to know how many clauses are still alive. And you're spending 80% of the time updating counters. So they came up with a clever data structure to do it, and so on and so forth. I won't go on into all the heuristics. These are five key heuristics. And there were two very important tools, I would say, GRASP, that came from Michigan in the mid-90s, and then 5 years later, Schaff from Princeton. And these tools have been accepted in wide industrial usage. And the field has moved today. There is an annual competition. And today we solve problems with millions of variables. I said this happened over really a period of about 20 years. So we went from hundreds of variables to millions of variables. A colleague of mine, Sandeep Sesha, a few years ago, decided to take 12 years of such solvers and take one benchmark problem and run it on a 2012 machine. So usually everyone come, every paper, but a different machine. He said, let's compare them to each other. And on this benchmark problem, that in 2000 took 800 seconds, by 2012 it is 1 second. The progress is so dramatic that people are starting to talk about Moore's law for such solvers. which is really kind of a joke, but nobody can really explain this dramatic progress. Okay? How we took a problem that 20 years ago we thought was an impossible, intractable problem, and today it is so tractable that Microsoft Research has been very aggressive, not only in developing very good SAT solver, they have a SAT solver called Z3, which they use very widely, but they've been doing very successful in tech transfer. So today, doing SAT solving is an industrial reality. So we went from a niche academic activity to a mainstream industrial activity. So there are all kinds of, these are all activity being used by Microsoft, not Microsoft Research. Microsoft Corporation, as it develops software, they have huge clusters in which people run nothing but SAT solvers. So this is, to me, an absolutely amazing development. This is also widely known, and one reason I'm here is to tell you, wow, the world has changed in a very dramatic way. Now, this is the first half of the talk, and what I want to do in the second half is to say, well, now that we can do that, what else can we do with it? So there is a famous saying, I don't know who said it, once a mathematician has a technique, it's like a hammer. If you have a hammer, you do, what do? You look for nails, okay? So let's go look for nails. So let's go back to talk about software and hardware and development. Software, hardware development, you look at this industry, it's a huge industry. It's a $250 billion a year industry. And of course, a major activity is building systems. And when you talk to people who design systems, whether hardware or software, they will tell you that sometimes they say 70-80% of the design effort is really validation. You design something, how do you know that it does what you wanted it to do? And this is called functional validation, okay? There's a whole other thing, functional verification. There's also issue of performance, I'm ignoring it. But just checking that it does, it has intended functionality is a huge undertaking. Now, in the research community, we usually talk a lot about formal verification. I mean, there are several Turing awards have been given. I can think of Floyd, Hoare, Milner, Pnuelli, Clark, Emerson, Sisla, all essentially around formal verification. So it's really hard to find precise data, but when I talk to people in the industry and I ask them to look at the person hours invested in this activity, 10% is a generous estimate. Okay, in some of the more advanced places, maybe Microsoft, Intel, I'm not talking about every small software company, it probably does nothing. Well, how do people really verify programs? They do it the same way that you may remember when you were undergraduate students, you stick print statements and you run it, okay? Pretty much so. This is now has a nice name, it's called dynamic verification. And you simulate the system under different testing scenarios, and you see did you get the right answer, and this is 90% plus of really what takes place in the industry. So let's zoom in a little bit. This is the dominant approach. And you basically simulate the system under many, many different possible input. And the inputs reflect different scenarios that you want to simulate. And then you compare the result to what you want. What you get from the simulation and the result, the ideal result. And you see whether you got the right result. And the challenge is the test space is astronomically large. Okay, let's see one concrete example. So there was one of the most famous bugs in the industry. In 1995, Intel came up with a Pentium, and the Pentium couldn't do floating point division correctly. So everybody now knows today, the next time this comes out to the market, somebody will lose their job, okay? This is some mistake you can do only once. So imagine that we are trying to verify floating point division, and let's suppose you're dealing with numbers with 128 bits, and suppose we try to do it for all values in X and Y, and are 2 to the 156 possibilities. This is a cosmologically large number, and the sun will go nova before we are done, and everybody knows this is not scalable. So we cannot cover the whole test space exhaustively. So what should we do? So the classical approach is that you need to sit down and think very hard and write test cases. So there are people, that's what they do, they write test cases. In fact, when I was at IBM, I was asked to help with a testing problem. IBM was developing a disk drive controller, and they had about 100 people who were writing test cases. And it turns out to write a test case is like writing code, so you can do about 20 per day. So 100 people do that. That means that every day we're generating about 2,000 possible testing scenarios. And IBM decided to invest in it, and they bought a hardware emulator. The hardware emulator runs about 100,000 times faster than software simulation. And these 2,000 cases, they would run them in about 30 seconds. And then for the rest of the day, these things would sit idle, waiting for the next day when a new batch would come out. And some manager had to explain why he spent $5 million on a system that is utilized for 30 seconds per day. So I was asked if I can help. And so IBM eventually came up with a different approach, which has become the de facto industry standard. And what is the approach? The test case designer do not write test cases. Instead, they write constraints that describe scenarios. Okay, for example, they write constraints that says the two numbers are both very large or both very small, and one is very large and one is very small. And you give it to a constraint solver, and the solutions are your test vectors. Okay, so this has become now the standard approach in industry. It's called random constraint test generation. So now we have constraints. We give it to a constraint solver to give us test vectors, but we want the constraint solver to give us solutions which are random and chosen uniformly. Now, why should they be random? Because remember, you're looking for a bug. You have no idea where the bug is. But the constraint solver has its own search, internal search. We saw all the heuristic. There's no reason to believe that the way the constraint solver finds a solution would correspond to the bug. I don't know where the bug is. Right? Imagine I'm trying to hit the dart. I'm trying to hit throw a dart at the board, but the circles are not marked. So I should do it randomly, but also uniformly, because I have no reason to prefer one part of the space over another part of the space. So this gives us the following question. You're given a SAT formula. The constraints often are not written in terms of Boolean formula, but it can be reduced to Boolean formulas. You're given a Boolean formula, and you want not to find a solution. You want to find random solutions uniformly. Okay, how can we do that? How can we? Now, we assume that we have a very good SAT solver that can solve huge problems, but we want to get uniformly random solution. So this is the problem that really is important for This problem came from industrial applications. Turns out there's many, many other applications. This is really, you think of it as a canonical problem. So I talked about constraint random test generation. I get the same problem. I talk to my colleagues who do MOOCs, and they have a course with 100,000 students, and there are bulletin boards where people are talking incessantly. And so if you give them all one problem, somebody will post the solution. That means that you have to generate, every assignment, you have to generate 100,000 different problems. So how do you do that? So the answer is the same thing. You write constraints. You constrain the space of there are parameters in the problem. You write constraints over these parameters. And now you want to generate solutions uniformly at random. Optimization. Think of any optimization problem. Very often you don't want to get in a local optimum. You want to simulate annealing, you want to jump from there to another place, but you still have to satisfy some constraints, and you want to do it again. Your best way is to do it randomly. In machine learning, this is a big deal. You had some initial probabilistic model. Now you got some additional evidence. You want to condition, you want to state the evidence, and you want to sample after the condition. So there are many, many instances of this problem, which is you're given a constraint, you want to sample uniformly at random. So the people in the theoretical community have been studying it now for 30 years. The first paper by Jerome Valiant and Vazirani, random generation of combinatorial structure from a uniform distribution, precisely this problem. And they solved it. They have a randomized polynomial time with a sigma P2 oracle. I won't get into what is a sigma P2 oracle, because the result was improved some years later by Belarek, Goldrach, and Petrank. And they were able to show how you do it using a randomized polynomial algorithm with an NP oracle. What does it mean to have NP oracle? For example, you have a randomized PTAM algorithm that calls a SAT solver. So in 2011, after I realized that this is an important industrial problem, and I recruited an undergraduate student, and I said, let's try to implement what we call the BGP, Bellare-Goldreich-Petrang algorithm. Beautiful algorithm, let's implement it. So we implemented it, and it scaled to N equals 16 proposition variables. I remember talking to the students, I said, you know, very nice, you put a good effort. I have to tell you, we cannot even submit it to a workshop. Because if we submit a workshop and we say we solve it for N equals 16, this is in 2011. People are already solving huge SAT problems. And we say we can do it for N equals 16, I said the program committee will not reject the paper, they will laugh at the paper. I can imagine the meeting where they're rolling on the floor laughing, looking at Vardy's most recent submission. I said, if we get to 1,000 variables, maybe we can send it to a third-tier workshop, but 16 is not even publishable. So I said it's a very important problem. So what do people do in the industry? So there are two approaches you find in the industry. I can't really explain too much for lack of time, but one is based on what's called BDD, binary decision diagrams, which are type of branching programs. And what you can do on these diagrams, from every node, you can count precisely how many solutions do you have. That enables you to take a random walk on that data structure and get a uniform distribution. So this is a perfectly adequate solution. You can handle roughly up to 1,000 variables. After that, the diagram gets to be too large and it's not very useful. There's another technique that's incredibly popular today in the machine learning world, and say people talk about the MCMC, which is Markov chain Monte Carlo. That's a big, big, big field, and this is a standard technique today, completely standard technique today in any kind of machine learning. Everybody uses MCMC techniques. So what you do is you build a Markov chain of the space. And you know you can prove that the Markov chain has a property that if you look at work which is long enough, then you reach what's called a stationary distribution. This is your ideal distribution, and then you can sample. The question is, how long is the work? And people work in many, many special cases. People talk about rapidly mixing Markov chain where the work is short. But in general, the work has to be proportional to the size of the Markov chain, which means exponential, so it's not feasible. So what do? You don't go that long. You take a shorter walk until you lose patience, and then you sample, but then you're not uniform, and we can say nothing about the degree of uniformity. So the other thing that people do, they say, let's take the SAT solver, and let's insert inside all kind of randomized steps. Let's choose a variable at random. Let's choose a value at random. And the answer is, people have tried to see how uniform is what you get. It's very, very non-uniform because it depends on all the action of the SAT solver. So people have looked at it and you get very patchy, very non-uniform distributions. So neither of these approaches works well in practice. And over the last few years, and I should of course mention, all of this work is due to NSF grants. I could not have done this work without NSF grants supporting me and my students. In particular, this is a result of an expedition that we are in the last year of, and a recent grant that I have also from IIS. So together with my collaborator, and here Fremont and Mill are PhD students, we have a new sampler that does almost uniform. I'll explain in a minute what is almost uniform. It's called Unigen. It's based on a universal hashing, which is an old theoretical idea, and I'll explain. It depends on SMT solver, which is a new idea, and I'll explain. It can handle millions of variables. And really what it requires is that you spend some time pre-processing, and then you can run a whole farm of workstations. Each one can do its own, generate its own independent samples. Okay? So it does what it should do for sampling, which it should be able to do it in parallel. So, of course, we have to compromise. The one compromise is we cannot do it uniformly. Uniformly is, as we saw, very difficult. We do it almost uniformly. What does it mean to do it almost uniformly? So suppose you have a formula phi, and you have a solution space solution of phi, and you have kappa solutions, then the uniform probability would be 1 over kappa. We do it within a factor. You give us an epsilon, and we will do it within divide 1 over kappa by 1 over epsilon, and multiply by 1 over epsilon. So let's suppose use epsilon is 0.1. That means that we are 1.1 factor away from the uniform probability. And the smaller the epsilon, we see the smaller the epsilon, the higher the computational price. So what are the ideas here? So this kind of reminds me of a very old story, which is how do you catch a lion in the desert? First, you cut the desert randomly in half. The lion will be in one half. You cut that part in half. Again, the lion will be in one quarter. You keep doing it. Eventually, you get a piece of land that is so small that the lion has to stand like this. And then you quickly tie the lion's feet together. Okay? So that's really what we do. We divide this whole solution space, which is a space that we understand very little. It's not a space that we have any understanding. All you have is a constraints. We have no idea what the solutions look like. I'll show you how we divide it into roughly small equal cell, and then we pick a random cell. Every cell is small enough that we can enumerate the solutions in the cell, and then we just pick randomly, uniformly one of these solutions, and we got something which is almost uniform because the cells are only almost equal. They're not exactly equal. This is the basic idea. Divide the solution space into cells. By the time a cell maybe has only 100 solutions, we can enumerate them and then choose one randomly. And so the challenge for us is, how do you take a space that you know nothing about and you partition it almost uniformly? Okay? How do we do that? This is the magic of universal hashing. So hashing is a very fundamental concept in computer science. You have a large space, 0, 1 to the n, so all the bit vectors of length n, and you want to map it to a much, much smaller space, 0, 1 to the m, so m is much, much smaller than n. Now, if you go back to the old Knuth volumes where he discussed hash functions, there was a discussion of good hash function. What is a good hash function? If you have a good initial distribution, the hash function should not screw it up. If you start with well-distributed inputs, the hash function will give you well-distributed outputs. But people realize that it's not working because we know nothing about the initial inputs. They can be highly concentrated. So here there is the idea of universal hashing. You have a family of hash functions. You choose one randomly, and you randomize over the initial distribution. And it doesn't matter what initial distribution, you're guaranteed to get nice output distribution after you chose the hash function at random. So the universal family is the one that does this job. But it's not enough, because remember, we do sampling here. So there's really another requirement. A sample better be independent, because I'm not independent. Imagine I have one sample and then I use it again and again and again. It's uniform, but it's not independent. How do I do it independently? So I need a hash function not only to give things, to create uniformity, but also to create independence. And here comes the concept of R-universality. So this is a parameter. And what it says, if you are R-universal, it means that every R inputs are hashed independently. The higher R, the more independence you have. In particular, for example, the cells are going to be more and more uniform the higher the R. In fact, we know how to generate high R universality by using polynomial of higher and higher degree. So this is all well understood. The problem is the higher universality means higher degree polynomial and for harder to solve, higher complexity. Now, BGP, which was a theoretical paper, they use the highest possible universality, n universality. Okay? Remember, n is the number of variables. So even for n equals 16, we already had to use fairly high degree polynomials. If we went from even bigger than that, it's not feasible. So we had to work hard to show that you can do that with very low universality, which means you can use very low degree polynomials. I'll show the polynomials in a minute. And this is where we get also that we get, instead of uniform generation, we get almost uniform generation. So the mathematical part of the paper was to show that we can do it with very low universality. But this enabled us to go from tens of variables to millions of variables. The other important question is, how do we do this? What are the specifics of this hash function? So actually, it's a very simple hash function. We generate a bunch of additional constraints. For every constraint, we take we select variables with uniform probability, and we write this kind of an equation. This is addition modulo 2, so this you can think of as exclusive OR. So we every variable, we flip a coin, and we either include it or not include it. So we get roughly half the variable in every equation, and then we choose 0 or 1 uniformly. So this is a hyperplane that cuts through randomly through the solution space. And we do M of such additional constraints. So we get 2 to the M cells this way. Okay? And whatever is the solution space, because we are cutting randomly, with high probability, we're going to get about half the solutions on either side. Now, the challenge for us is that now we get a problem that consists of the CNF, conjunction normal form, the initial part of the input, conjunction of disjunction, but now we also have XOR clauses. Now, you can convert. Now, notice that XOR clauses by themselves are easy to solve because they're simply linear equations modulo 2, so high school students should be able to solve them. Just Gaussian eliminations, you do everything modulo 2. And there are lots of solvers that can do this. You know, we can solve huge systems of linear equations. That's actually very easy. But now we have this combination of CNF and XOR clauses. So we can reduce, we know how to reduce, there is efficient reduction of XOR clauses to CNF clauses, but then we lose the easiness of XOR clauses. And so if we do that, it's a no-go. We try to do that, doesn't work at all. And now comes a new technology into the picture, and this is called SMT solving. What is SMT solving? SMT solving is satisfiability modulo theory. Okay? What does it mean? A few years after the SAT revolution started, people says, can we leverage it to do more sophisticated automated reasoning techniques? Can we combine the Boolean reasoning with, let's say, a linear programming? Can we handle disjunctions of linear inequalities, for example? And so we want to combine Boolean reasoning with another, with consent from another domain, and that's called the theory. The theory is another domain of constraints. And this has been, again, a very active area of research for the past 15 years, tremendous progress today in solving combination of Boolean and other type of constraints. In 2009, a European researcher, Matthew Suess, decided to try to use SAT solver to break cryptographic keys. So for cryptographic keys, you have to reason about, you have to do modular arithmetic, so he introduces a combination of CNF and XORs. And it combines SAT solving with Gaussian elimination in a very clever way. His attempt to break cryptographic keys this way was an utter failure, but the solver was sitting there waiting for us when we needed to be able to solve. This is called the serendipity factor, right? One person's solution is another person's success. And when we try to solve our problem and we did not do well by reducing it to CNF, we started using Google aggressively. We found this solver, and this was like, voila, manna from heaven. And he could not be happier because he was, you know, he left academia, he went to industry, and 5 years later we tell him, your solver is the key to our success. So how good is the performance now? So this is the difference is between, I went a couple of weeks ago, I gave a talk on this at the Simon Institute, and I said the difference between the theoreticians there and what we do is we actually run the algorithms. We don't just prove that we have an algorithm, we run the algorithm. So one is we want to know how uniform is it. So we took a formula that has 16,000 solutions, and we generated about 4 million samples. So you can think of it, I have 16,000 beans, and I draw at random now uniformly 4 million balls, and I throw them in the beans. And now I will get different counts. Some beans will have a small number, some, you know, it's random. Some beans will have a large number. I can look at each count, how many times it occurs. This is very well understood in probability theory, and people know that in the limit, you should get a Poisson distribution. We don't go to the limit. So instead, what we did, we implemented this uniform sampler, and we compared it to our sampler, and this is the distribution of the counts, and they're statistically indistinguishable. So what we do, what we generate, is statistically indistinguishable from uniform probability. What about the performance? We benchmark ourselves against the at the time, this was 2013, the best sampler that we get from the AI community, developed by Bart Selman at Cornell. It's called ExoSample Prime. It's a sampler that offers no guarantee of uniformity. It's purely heuristical. It is based on a combination of it's based on MCMC techniques, and we outperform it by 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. So we get, using this technique, we get not only guaranteed almost uniformity, but also fantastic performance. So this was such a success that we decided to see if we can, we went to look for another nail. The next nail was counting. So what do we do with counting? You want to count how many solutions there are. Okay, so if I look at the formula P or Q, you can see that P has to be true, and Q or Q has to be true, so there are 3 solutions. P is true, Q is true, and both are true. Now this is, again, this is a counting solution. It's a well-understood problem in complexity theory. This is called sharp-P. Sharp-P is the problem of counting how many solutions you have for an NP-complete problem. Sharp-SAT is well known. It's a canonical sharp-P complete problem. Okay, so sharp-P is well understood, and it's known to be actually a very much harder problem. So while SAT has kind of become easy, and I'll come back to what I mean by easy in quotes, sharp-SAT is a difficult problem. Now again, this is a problem that has many applications. For example, in the context of constant random verification, you would like to have some idea what is the size of the solution space before you start generating solution. How long should you go? You need some ideas of the size of the solution space. It is heavily used in AI. In AI, this is a big problem. In fact, most of our publications now have been in AAAI, in Ichikai, Bayesian inference, training with uncertainty, more and more. And this is a very hard problem. I mean, this is much harder than SAT. Okay? Typically, you have exact solvers for sharp SAT, and they can handle thousands of variables, not more than that. So, again, we are going to compromise. We're not going to do exact counting. We're going to do approximate counting. And this is called PAC, probably approximately correct, which was an idea due to Larry Stockmeyer. And this is even before Valen introduced PAC learning. And the idea, again, you look at the count, but you want it to be within tolerance of 1 plus epsilon over and under, and you only within certain high probability, okay? It doesn't have to be with full probability 1, you allow yourself the probability. And again, theoreticians solved this problem going back to 1989. They proved that it is in BPP, which is randomized polynomial time. Let's not worry too much about the details, with an NP oracle. There was no implementation so far, and by now we understand if we just went and implemented the algorithm, it would scale to, again, something like N equals 16. These algorithms are not scalable. So, we want to use the same approach. The approach is divide the space into small cells, use the exos to divide the space into small cells. In each cell, I can count the number of solutions because the cells are small enough. By multiplying the number of solutions in a single cell by 2 to the m, I get an estimate for the whole solution space. I sample enough cells, I get an estimate with high enough confidence. Okay? And I get an algorithm, which is, again, it's polynomial in the number of variables in 1 over epsilon, inverted log 1 minus delta, which is the confidence, and using, however, of course, it's exponential dumb algorithm. All this algorithm, they call SAT solver. So in principle, they are exponential dumb algorithms. For problems that have up to thousands of variables, we can compare ourselves against an exact counter. Cache is an exact counter, one of the tools of the industry. We use epsilon 0.75. In all the cases, we fall within the tolerance, the 0.75, even though we have a probability of, we allow ourselves with some probability to deviate, it never happens in practice. And in practice, our accuracy is 4%. Even though we set the parameter of 75% error, our actual accuracy is 4%, and it means that somebody smarter than us we should be able to do a tighter analysis, explain why we're getting such low error. But it's a fantastic accuracy. And cache works well on some problem up to thousands of variables. Our experience is cache either terminates in 5 minutes or it never terminates. It just keeps going forever. And we can handle much larger problem. Today we can handle problem with millions of, not millions of variables, hundreds of thousands of variables. Again, because we need to do many, many sampling so we can handle hundreds of thousands of variables. So I want to get into the end of the talk. I want to stop and do some reflection on what does this tell us about this outstanding question, P versus NP. So I think when I was a freshman student, one of my graduates asked me if I know the difference between theory and practice, and I couldn't come up with any answer that would be clever enough until I told me the standard cliche, which is, in theory, they're not very different, but in practice, they're very different. So there is a huge difference between P versus NP in theory and in practice. In practice, it is conceivable that P equal NP, and it will do us no good, because, for example, everything could be done with a polynomial n to the thousand, and therefore it will be completely impractical. So we could prove tomorrow that P equal NP, it will have no practical application whatsoever. Or we could prove that P is different than NP, but maybe it's all in n to the log n, which is not polynomial because it's not a fixed degree. The same graduate TA was a clever guy, I just don't remember his name, asked us, what is the limit of log n when n goes to infinity? So we said, we are students. We know, we are college students. It's infinity. He said, no. In practice, it's about 50. For no number in the universe, log is bigger than 50. So if you have an algorithm with n to the log n, it might be a very practical algorithm. So it could be that NP is different than P, but it's still very tractable. So we can solve P versus NP, and there might be no practical benefit one way or another. Quite possible. We have to accept that this is a possibility. But the deeper than that is, when I was a graduate student, NP complete was scary. That was a scary poly. It was NP complete. It meant, don't touch it. Don't even look at it. You know, you might be contaminated by looking at it. But today, in fact, SAT is a hard problem. We know that SAT is a hard problem. We can synthetically generate instances with hundreds of variables that no SAT solver can solve. Yet, we are solving that problem with millions of variables. We have no good theory that will explain to us why some SAT instances are hard and some are difficult. So we have a fantastic theoretical challenge to understand the actual performance of SAT solvers. But beyond that, if in general, SAT is easy, what does it now mean for the rest of computing? What else can we do with it? I just showed you, for example, the problem that were considered impossible, sampling and counting, are now become very, very feasible. What else can we do when you have SA? What other nails can we found? Is BPP to the NP, okay, which is randomized polynomial time, calling SAT, is this the new polynomial time? I think this is the time that we really need to perhaps rethink some of the standard assumptions in theoretical computer science. Thank you very much.
It's already 3:00. If some of you have other appointments, please feel free to leave. But we will continue with a couple of questions.
I apologize, this is a dumb question, but when you were saying unigen, at the beginning there was the generation of a random sequence. And I was wondering that, I guess I understand a little bit, that not all random number generators are created equal. Is there a relationship between the quality of the random number and the quality of the distribution?
No, this is actually a very good question. So in reality, what you do is you use the network behavior to generate a random seed. And then you use what's called a pseudo-random number generator to generate the sequence. To get real random bits, actually, it's difficult. In fact, we started beginning with harvesting little random bits. There are places that give you random bits from quantum phenomena, etc. But then what happened, we didn't have enough random bits. We had to reuse them. And actually, that was worse. So it's actually interesting theoretical question. Is what happened, and people have looked at it. What happened? You take randomized algorithm. They assume that all bits are random, and you use pseudo-random bits. Okay, and for very small number of problems, we understand the difference. Okay, and usually the bounds, if you really want provable, the bounds are worse. Okay, so there is a certain fudge factor here, But the answer is that in practice, nobody can distinguish these pseudo-random bits from random bits. We don't have a statistical test that can make this distinction.
So you have an NP complete problem. You transfer it into SAT.
Yes.
Transfer it into SAT. Then you use SAT solver to give you quick solutions.
Yeah.
What sort of NP complete problems does that work?
So let's suppose that I want to generate random colorings of graphs. Okay, so think about it. Every NP complete problem, very often you prove it by you show that it has a reduction to SAT. That means that we can then use a SAT solver. Okay, so knapsack problem. I mean, there are a whole variety of problems that you can now say, okay, I can now use it by reduction to SAT. But in some sense, this is one way to reduce it to SAT and use this approach. But you can think of the other direction one can say. So what we've shown is how you can take a solver and universal hashing to do sampling and counting. Can you take these ideas to other domains? Okay. So can I go, for example, can I go to linear programming and devise some kind of hash function and augment NP solver with the ability to solve this hash function and being able, for example, to estimate, you know, there is a canonical questions in LAMP programming, you have a bunch of constraints, what is the volume of the polytope, okay? So it's not clear that always reducing to SAT is the right approach, but it's a general paradigm here, which is that universal hashing with constraint solving can be a very powerful combination. And one of the directions that we are actually now looking at is exactly this direction, okay? Can we go to other constraint domains and have the similar algorithmic components?
So if these fast SAT solvers are all based on heuristics, I could see how they'd be very important for problems with incorrect solution, not critical. They'd be used for problems where they...
No, the SAT solver heuristics are only improving the performance. The SAT solvers are always correct. They make no mistakes. Okay, they never, you know, they are. You can check the final solution. So the all the heuristics are trying to speed up the runtime. There's no compromise here on the corrections of the SAT solver.
But the problem you pose is checking a computer program for correct.
Yeah. The SAT solver are sound and complete. Okay. The only thing that could happen sometimes, I mean, they will take too long and you'll give up before you have a solution. Okay. But there is no, we're not compromising here. Where we do get approximate answer. Easy now, either sampling or counting, but then we're very precise. We're telling you exactly what kind of compromise we're doing. We're telling you what is the tolerance, what is the probability. We have precise what we call approximation guarantee.
So just going back to John's question, so you mentioned that reducing things is probably not the preferred way.
For some problem, yes. For some problem, it would be better to move to their domain.
Millions of variables here. What is the corresponding thing that you're solving for algorithm?
So one of the things, I mean, there are some technicalities that I will not get into, but one of the things that you do reduction is you generate, for example, extra variables, okay? And so the answer is that we have a way of dealing with extra variables. So we don't need to sample over all variables. We can sample over all sampling sets. So the various algorithmic details that enable us to deal with reduction to SAT. So even if you have a reduction to SAT, it introduces new variables. That's not a problem for us.
I have one question. In all the counting techniques, like finding the volume of a convex object, it is done in stages because if you do all in one step, the number of times you have to do it many, many times. Here you indicated that you are doing it in one.
So we started now to compare this approach to polynomial time approaches.
Yes.
This has been a major activity in the theory community now for the past 25 years. And some beautiful, beautiful results have come up, okay? Proving, for example, that approximating the permanent is in polynomial time, you know, and all kind of things like that. And we're starting to do the comparison, and so it's a bit too early, but I expect, and I may prove you wrong, but this point is an expectation, these methods will perform much, much better than probably polynomial methods. Some of these probably polynomial algorithms have complexity of n to the 7. You can do the calculation. What happens if n equal 20? Then n to the 7 is already a huge number. Okay? It's, what is it? It's about I think trillion. Okay, and so we are really, I said, we are in the beginning of revising our thinking about algorithms and complexity, and we'll see where it takes us.
Thank you very much.
That concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.